And good afternoon and welcome to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with Laron Landis. The late Patty Fink is going to be very, very late today. She'll be here next week. Our guest today is the Reverend Steve Sprinkle. Steve, you haven't been with us in a long time. Steve is on the faculty of Bright Divinity School. He's an ordained Baptist minister, the author of Unfinished Lives, and apparently a new book coming out soon.
I hope.
Hope. Okay. One of the classes he's teaching this fall, now I did say he's an ordained Baptist minister. We'll figure that one out in a minute. But he's teaching ministry in the LGBT community, which I understand they're also teaching, or you're teaching it for them over here at Criswell College?
They actually reversed their contract.
I see.
As you
say. I see. Okay, so... I want to just start off with this. I didn't mention it before the show because I just want your, you know, just your honest opinion.
Right.
Robert Jeffress, explain.
Robert Jeffress is easy to explain.
Oh, okay.
Robert Jeffress is a frustrated man who has made his fame in ministry by being opposed to people, especially people he believed did not have the voice to speak for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so... he's been completely consistent, at least in that regard.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That was easy.
That was easy. I thought I was going to throw that at. Okay, now, you are an ordained Baptist minister,
yes.
And I remember one time Steve was teaching a class at our synagogue, and he and I were just exchanging, and I don't even remember what the topic of the class was, but what I remember, do you remember what it was?
No.
Okay. But we were having this interesting conversation, and we're getting more and more riled, and finally Steve just said to me, David, you do understand your beliefs and my beliefs are more similar than my beliefs and those from First Baptist Church.
Yes.
So, so when I say you're a Baptist minister, most people are surprised that you're a gay Baptist minister,
yes.
But you're not a Southern Baptist minister.
No. I belong to a group called the Alliance of Baptists, which is the only North American convention of Baptists that is open and inclusive of LGBT folks and women, and is utterly ecumenical, too. So that makes us on the far left wing of Baptists everywhere.
Yeah, I didn't know such a group even existed.
It's kind of refreshing.
It is.
Yes. And as some historic Baptist conventions become more and more politicized and more conservative, then the good folks and good congregations among them, which have identified as open and affirming of LGBT people, continue to choose the Alliance to affiliate with. It makes perfect sense. They're able to preserve their Baptist heritage, and at the same time, they believe enact what true Baptist life is about,
mm-hmm.
Separation of church and state, the challenge to make personal matters of faith and practice, and the lack of judgment toward each other.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the class that you're teaching.
Yes.
Ministry in the LGBT community, because I find that fascinating.
Yep.
There was a discussion among synagogues. A lesbian couple comes into our synagogue. What do we do? And the answer to that was, say hello.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes,
indeed. And that's an actual question that was out there on the boards that rabbis answer each other, with problems and questions and religious concerns that they have. What do? We say hello. But you're saying there is a difference in ministering to the LGBT community.
Well, because the community really does have particular needs. Anytime you're dealing with folks who have historically been identified as a marginalized community, they're going to carry certain burdens and certain needs along with them. It doesn't mean that every member of that community unanimously agrees with everyone else,
mm-hmm.
or carries the same kind of baggage. We all don't. As a matter of fact, what makes the LGBT community distinct is that it is a community bound together in difference, not necessarily in sameness.
Mm-hmm.
But the LGBTQ community carries within it not only particular needs, but it has a host of treasures and gifts to share with faith communities and neighborhoods all throughout America. And in our class, that's one of the things we try to identify. Not only the pains and sorrows, but also the strengths and promise that's carried within this extraordinary community.
Right. So the class is not, oh, you poor people.
Mm-mm. No, sure it's not. But can you talk a little bit about how such a class, you know, with our community, is sometimes a challenge to even get those people to let them know that, hey, we love you also.
Of course. The LGBTQ community historically has had a great deal of friction with organized religion in this country, mostly because organized religion has been identified conservatively, with conservative social values and conservative political values, with conservative family structures. I know that the now retired Bishop of New Hampshire, Bishop Gene Robinson, said that for the LGBTQ community, about 95% of all of our problems could be dealt with if the religion question were joined and settled. The quickest way in the LGBTQ community to get into an argument is to raise the question of religion. So you understand that. Religion and religious people have exacted a terrible price upon LGBT people. The Abrahamic religions, all of them, have had that kind of heritage. But it has not been exclusively that way. As a matter of fact, if you look here in the United States of America for the earliest LGBT predominant community of faith that I know anything about, I think it will surprise you. And that is that in 1947, the Ecumenical Catholic Church established its first congregation in Atlanta, Georgia. 1947. It wasn't in New York. It wasn't in San Francisco. It was in hot Atlanta. That's where it started.
Wow. And is that because people in the South tend to be raised more religiously?
In that particular instance, it was. It was founded by a former seminarian, Roman Catholic seminarian, who was ordained by a former Eastern Orthodox bishop. So the two of them established the Ecumenical Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, a branch of that very congregation still exists, but it's now in Toronto, Canada. It had a very durable history. The beginnings of the human rights movement, as we know it in our world today, actually had its roots in religious communities. And there has been this very strong, although sometimes tense, relationship between religion and the LGBTQ community.
Sure.
Witness the fact that I teach this course in Bright Divinity School, which is a mainstream Protestant Christian confessing seminary in Fort Worth, Texas.
A very red city.
It's a very red city, but the matter of the fact is that Bright Divinity School has made the choice for the sake of its own faith and witness to move in this direction. I first taught this course 17 years ago at Bright.
Has it changed?
Well, it certainly has changed. This class that has come in to take this course is the largest one I've ever taught. Now we have 26 in an upper-level elective course. They are gay and straight. They are transgender and cisgender. They are racially, ethnically diverse. It's a beautiful cross-section of what our student body looks like. And I think that they have basically come to us this time out of a real passion for what we do now, especially in the wake of the Pulse nightclub massacre in Orlando back in June. Yeah. I think that's one reason that that enrollment has been so high in this course this time.
And that makes sense. We're going to talk a little bit more about Pulse probably in our next segment.
Sure.
I'm just really fascinated by this class. Okay, so in 17 years, mm-hmm. AIDS was certainly probably topic number one back then.
Well, and when I first started this course, we had difficulty finding textbooks that we could use mm-hmm. for a course like this.
Sure.
Because they really were not that many books that were in publication that dealt with this topic. Now, the list of books is enormous in the field. So the struggle is to limit the books.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've chosen seven required texts. They're excellent, but they're among many, many other books. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that certainly an issue that has come to the fore in the last three cycles of the class has been the emergence of transgender voices among us. And that's been challenging and refreshing.
And I would think just even so the clergy not just can work with transgender, but so that they understand what transgender people are, who yeah. they are.
Yep.
Yeah. I know you attribute some of the higher enrollment now to the, you know, as a direct response to what happened in Pulse, but do you also attribute some of that to just the changing times with the younger generations?
Partly that, I think. The Divinity School has served as a beacon for LGBT people all through the southwestern United States. Mm-hmm. We are the only school in the Southwest and in the Great Plains that offers a full experience of seminary to LGBTQ people. And that's not to say that other seminaries don't accept LGBTQ folks, but by policy passed by our Board of Trustees, we celebrate sexual orientation, gender identity, and gender expression mm-hmm. at Bright Divinity School. So students come from all over the United States and outside the United States to study there. Our dean at mm-hmm. Bright Divinity School, who is a friend of your radio show too, Jaretta Marshall.
Mm-hmm.
Jaretta is an open and out lesbian. She's a United Methodist in full connection. So it's an unusual setting. Which is not to say that LGBT people or LGBT concerns predominate at Bright Divinity School. We're a diverse school with black church studies and borderland studies for Latino Latinas. We have a Jewish studies program there of which we are justly proud. We've also got a Korean Asian church studies program there that's growing.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a part of the diverse American landscape, these younger people, like you've identified, have wanted to come to a school where they can have a challenging, full-rounded experience as spiritual people.
You know, it almost seems like it should be required, because if they're going to be serving any kind of congregation that's of any size whatsoever, there are going to be LGBT people in their congregation.
That is certainly the case. Mm-hmm. And that's the commitment that we've made as a faculty at Bright Divinity School.
Mm-hmm.
If we're going to educate religious leaders, then they're going to have to be at home in the midst of mixed and diverse communities, because that's where we serve, that's where we live,
mm-hmm.
that's where our children are reared up.
Okay, so I want to go back to what are some of the topics that you're actually going to hit?
Okay. Right off the bat, of course, people begin to question the use of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And what we are trying to do there is to empower our students to learn how to interpret these texts that sometimes have been interpreted negatively toward the LGBTQ community. But also, we're trying to train our students in order to equip members of their congregations and agencies so that they are able to read with intelligence, too, and they're able to interpret mm-hmm. for themselves. It's not just enough to call in experts and say, what do you think Romans 1 means, or what do you think that Leviticus 1820 means, or what do you think the story of Sodom and Gomorrah is about? It's much more an expression of intelligent and life-giving interpretational skills that can be applied to any part of the Bible. So that's the first thing. I'm concentrating on that first and foremost in the class, with the goal that our students will be able to be intelligent interpreters of these ancient texts, and will also be able to school their lay people to do the same for themselves. But beyond that, we have to be networkers too. If there are needs within our community, and there are plenty, then we need to find out where the professionals are, the psychological professionals, the social professionals, the legal professionals, who are going to be of assistance to people in need in our communities. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, what about our LGBTQ students who are committed to activism? There are forms of activism that I believe are more beneficial and positive than others. How do you begin advocacy that is going to benefit communities and not tear them down? Mm-hmm. That's an issue that we're concerned with, too.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the people that are going to be part of this class are going to be part of religious communities that are not of one mind about LGBTQ life and participation in communities mm-hmm. of faith. So how does an intelligent and spiritual leader move congregations and groups toward something like more perfect inclusion without...
Without excluding the people who have
yeah.
different beliefs.
Yep.
We need to take a break. You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with Laurent Landis. Our guest is the Reverend Steve Sprinkle of Bright Divinity School. We'll be back with more right after this.
Hi, I'm Cleve Jones, and you're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM.
And I'm Dave Taffet here with Laurent Landis, and we're talking to the Reverend Steve Sprinkle from Bright Divinity School. He is the author of the book Unfinished Lives, and Unfinished Lives is the book, it's one of those books you can't read it from beginning to end. Read a chapter, put it down, because it's that upsetting. And seriously, Steve, you have written one of the most upsetting books I've ever written, ever read. What it's about is people whose lives have been cut short through hate crimes, like right. Matthew Shepard is the one that everybody knows, but
there's many
a number
others.
Of stories, number of stories in there.
Yeah.
Which, when we were putting the show together today, we thought, you know, Pulse, 50 people, you have another book to come out.
I hope that I've got more books than that to come out.
But I'm talking about...
But on this subject,
on something that happened over just a couple of hours. And
that's right. There were a lot of people in the years since Unfinished Lives was written who believed that somehow this society had transcended hate crimes. Mm-hmm. They didn't hear much about them anymore, and they somehow were able to move along with other agendas without paying much attention. But the matter of the fact is, since President Obama signed the Matthew Shepard James Byrd Hate Crime Prevention Act into law in October of 2009, the numbers of hate crime attacks and murders has consistently risen. As a matter of fact, now, if you pay attention to the Federal Bureau of Investigation statistics, we are at historic highs.
Mm-hmm.
And Pulse, then, was an exclamation point that took place in the middle of that ongoing brutal narrative here in the United States of America.
Mm-hmm. Pulse took place in June, but the years from last September through June, there were a number of attacks. Fortunately, nobody killed. Fortunately, everybody who was attacked has recovered, that we know of, in Oak Lawn.
Yes.
Those weren't unfinished lives, thank God.
Yes.
But it came from the same sort of hate.
Yes, it does. And
when you're talking about hate crime statistics, by the way, of those 18, 19 attacks, only two of them are being classified as hate crimes because the victim heard an anti-gay slur during the attack. The others didn't hear it, or it just wasn't said. They were just attacks, so there's no proof.
Right.
But we know what it was.
Correct. The LGBTQ community in North Texas knows when attacks like this are targeted against LGBTQ victims of what that's about, which is not to say that there might not be other motives in play when a crime occurs. It would be very unusual in American life to find a crime that is cleanly identified as one category or another.
Mm-hmm.
So why would LGBTQ hate crimes be any different than that? Sometimes people are robbed. Sometimes there are domestic disputes. Sometimes there are explosions of anger in neighborhoods. That's not unusual.
Mm-hmm.
But what unites all these stories is a deep base tone, an underlying expression of heterosexism and homophobia that works its way out as victims are targeted. And that's what we've seen here in the Oak Lawn Cedar Springs neighborhood in Dallas. I think that is particularly what targeted the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida, when the killer had designated Latin Night in that very well-known and beloved nightclub as to be the time and the spot in which he would carry out his murderous intent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, going back to Paul's, it was just horrific, but I think for me, almost more horrific was some of the response from some people of the so-called faith community.
Oh, yeah.
You know, saying that we deserved it.
They
got the right people. One guy, even he got fired because he tweeted out. He said that he considered that doing community service. And now comes news that one of the pastors, and he's actually from Georgia, Ken Atkins, he said he was one of the pastors, several of them, who said that they got what they deserved. Now this week, he has just been arrested on two counts of child molestation.
Mm. So as a pastor, he's one of these people.
Yeah.
Right. Explain.
What do you say to that? Just horrific hypocrisy.
I want to start with, they got what they deserved. How can any pastor say that about 50 people who were murdered?
Down through the ages, religious leaders have been at the forefront of every conservative movement you can think of. They have been the sounding boards and amplifiers for xenophobia, nationalism, and for war. There's no question about that. But that does not mean that the totality of clergy everywhere, rabbis and imams and ministers and pastors and priests, are somehow disqualified as religious leaders because of the actions of a few.
Mm-hmm.
It's not unusual for someone who is suffering from some kind of latent self-hatred to go into a vocation for living that allows them somehow to try to work out their problems.
Mm-hmm.
You can see that in psychological counseling, which is secular, too. It doesn't have to be just religious. But this person that you were talking about, Laurent, who now has been charged with two counts of child molestation, is a person whose hypocrisy harmed a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
What we've found in the religious community is that it's all too often that voices like his are listened to, whereas the hundreds and thousands of voices of open and affirming clergy, of progressive folks, and of LGBTQ clergy ourselves are somehow strangely silenced in these conversations.
Good point.
Here in Dallas, we've had such courageous clergy leadership on the part of rabbis and ministers, mm-hmm. on the part of imams too, who've spoken out against persecution against marginalized groups, including the LGBTQ community. And I, for one, condemn the actions of this hypocritical minister and say that there is every reason to revoke his credentials as a minister.
Mm-hmm.
What business does he have portraying himself as a religious leader when hatred is actually the motive for his actions?
Well, and actually you're saying revoke his credentials. There are no state-authorized credentials.
No.
So somebody might have graduated from Bright Divinity School. That's his credentials. But then you have churches that ordain their own minister within the church.
Yeah, actually, Bright Divinity School does not give anyone clergy credential. What it does is it gives persons academic degrees. And the academic degrees are considered to be necessary for ordination or authorization to minister by the several religious groups who send students to us. Right now, for example, we have 31 different communions and religious traditions who send students to Bright Divinity School. We don't ordain a single one of them. Mm-hmm. They're ordained, that is, authorized to minister by their home congregations and by their tradition.
Your denomination.
That's right.
Does that, yeah.
And like you pointed out, just right, David, these groups all have their own criteria for acceptance and then for exclusion, mm-hmm. too. And we need to get to a point where intolerance toward LGBTQ folks is ought to be at a zero level. And I think all throughout religious communities, when members of these communities or their clergy express intolerance, then they ought to hear from their own parishioners, stop it, mm-hmm. quit, because that has nothing to do with your vocation as a religious leader.
And they should. And I know in Josh's and my denomination, we're happy to do that. But wouldn't you say that most parishioners in most churches, you're just not going to do that?
Well, funny thing is, though, a major survey was done not that long ago by the Pew Center, in which they were asking questions about the acceptance of LGBTQ people in religious communities. And its results were fascinating. When they interviewed members of these groups, lay members, not clergy leaders, over 60% of them said that they were just waiting for their clergy to lead them into more inclusive expressions of faith. And when the clergy were interviewed, more than 60% of them said they were waiting for their church members to come along and lead in those areas. So I think that the impulse in the country is toward more inclusion,
mm-hmm.
and we're finding more and more people willing to speak up.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we're getting more and more students from all across the country, many of whom identify as lesbian, bisexual, transgender, or gay.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're part of those communities and they want to lead it.
Getting back to Pulse.
Yes.
Pulse happened the beginning of June. Five Dallas officers were killed the end of June. Mm-hmm. And to me, the two are very related. One was an LGBT issue. One was a racial issue. But to me, they're very related. Would both of you agree?
I definitely agree.
I certainly do. And I'll go one step further than that. I think that that these two incidents were expressions of a brittleness in American culture and life right now. Deep-seated frustration. On the one hand, the Pulse nightclub massacre was carried out by a person who had deep animus, perhaps division within his own life and within his own soul about mm-hmm. LGBT concerns. In the case right here in Dallas, in which we saw police officers shot down, the person who carried that out was deeply angry and frustrated, apparently, over the shooting of young black men throughout the country.
We all were.
Yes, that's right. Protest that was carried on in the streets of Dallas was an expression of that frustration and that anger. Mm-hmm. The very protest that was being protected by police officers in the exercise of their First Amendment rights under the Constitution.
And we were talking about this again before the show, but what upsets me so much about it, I'm not calling the Dallas Police Department perfect. Nobody in the Dallas Police Department would call the Dallas Police Department perfect.
Sure.
But if any police department was the wrong one to target, it was that one.
Yes.
When Chief Brown came in, he fired 70 officers who he felt couldn't be police to the community.
All right.
Which is exactly what the problem has been.
Yes.
The officers during that demonstration, they were doing what Dallas police officers do, and I've rarely seen it elsewhere. I was down in Houston last year, not this past year, the year before, for the Pride Parade. Mm-hmm. And I'm used to our police officers that have a ball at our Pride Parade.
Yes.
They get chosen. They don't all get selected to be officers for the Pride Parade. The police officers in Houston were not happy. They were not having it. And you were going to march where you're supposed to, and people will stand where this... There was nothing friendly about it at all. Here, during the demonstration, the police officers were taking selfies with everybody in the demonstration. They were talking to everybody. They were walking along with them. And that's how they were protecting them.
Mm-hmm.
And themselves.
Yes.
By just participating in it, not by demonstrating, but by, keeping an eye out. But they were talking to every. But that's how I've seen Dallas police normally operate. Pick the wrong police department, and I don't want to say that there was a right police department
right.
for that, and that's not what I meant by it.
Yeah.
But if he was protesting a police department, Dallas has done everything that's been asked of police departments across the country.
Mm-hmm.
But most people wouldn't know that.
Right. So. We've seen the outbreak of physical violence, especially gun violence,
mm-hmm.
here in this country in the last 20 years. The great sadness for me about what happened in our streets here in Dallas with the police shooting in July is that it plays into a very negative narrative for Dallas.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
One that was rooted in the assassination of President Kennedy. We know that Dallas has transcended that story a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
We're a robust, active metropolitan area, one of the greatest cities in the country. But now what we've got to do is rebuild trust across communities.
Mm-hmm.
My friends who are from Orlando will say similar positive things about the Orlando Police Department, too,
mm-hmm.
and the way in which they moved heaven and earth to try to stop the killing that took place at the Pulse nightclub.
And did you hear what the two hospitals who took the victims
yeah.
did this week?
Yes.
They took me up.
Yeah. They just canceled all of the charges for anybody, for the 50 people who...
I think they said they're running off. It's like it's over $30 million.
Something like that.
It doesn't take away, of course, any of the pain and suffering. But what it does is restore something of our faith in humanity.
Absolutely.
You know, you're saying it doesn't take away some of any of the pain and suffering, but people who are recovering from injuries
yeah.
and are off work and now don't have to pay a huge hospital bill,
sure
that helps relieve their pain and suffering because they don't
will.
Have to worry as much. And when you
yeah.
don't worry, you heal better.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
So good things do happen, and we're glad about
right.
that.
Yeah.
I think we're at a good place here in Dallas, and the community is poised to move on to better and more beneficial mm-hmm. relationships with police and firefighters and city officials. Certainly, we're well led in the LGBTQ community. Appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I think LGBTQ faith leaders play their part. When we got word almost instantly from our friends in Florida that an attack had occurred at the Pulse nightclub. Clergy from this area and all through Texas who identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender began to speak out. Mm-hmm. And members of our religious communities turned to us and said, why? Mm-hmm. I think that an examination of the sermons delivered and the speeches delivered and the protests in the streets, especially, for example, the one we had at the Resource Center, following.
It was immediate. It was that day.
That's right. There were 1,000 people in the rain. Mm-hmm. And it was pouring rain, if you remember.
We need to take a break. We're talking to the Reverend Steve Sprinkle about variety of issues. I'm Dave Taffet. I'm here in the studio with Laurent Landis. The late Patty Fink will be back next week if her Ebola has subsided.
Yes.
We'll be back with more after this.
Hi, this is Belinda Lill, and I listen to Lambda Weekly. I hope that you will, too.
And thank you, Valletta. I'm Dave Taffet here with Laurent Landis, and the Reverend Steve Sprinkle is our guest today. Steve, you were saying you just have one more thing that you wanted to...
Yes.
Just to wrap that up.
The Pulse nightclub shooting and other expressions of anti-LGBTQ violence in the United States are often referred to as tragedies. Mm-hmm. That seems to be a common media narrative. Mm-hmm. It's the word of choice. If there is a mass shooting or if there is a confrontation that leads to the loss of someone's life, then that's supposed to be a tragedy. Mm-hmm. I beg to differ. Tragedies actually seem impersonal, and they've been used all throughout literary history as being a catharsis. It's a way of flushing the emotions out of the system. These things were not tragedies. They were outrages. There are outrages against civilized life. When anti-Semitism, when misogyny, when racial ethnic bigotry and racism and homophobia take lives, those are not tragedies. And I wish that we would adjust our language so that we can begin to keep the necessary healthy anger going, so that we can push our elected officials to make lasting changes.
And you know, from the beginning, I was referring to it in the paper as the Pulse Massacre.
Right.
To me, that's what it was, and that described it.
It was a mass assassination.
That's another way to... Yeah. That's another way to put it. I want to talk to you a little bit about Trump. We've avoided that subject as much as we could, but... As a Baptist minister, I think you can put some of this into terms that we'll understand. Mm-hmm. Because while you don't agree with a lot of what they do and believe and say and act and you do understand where they're coming from.
You mean evangelicals?
Evangelicals and other right-wing Christians. Now, here's what I don't understand. I understand why evangelicals supported Ted Cruz. They align on family issues, on religious issues, on all sorts of issues. They might disagree on something, but basically, that's their guy. And I understand why they would vote for the Republican nominee. I don't understand, though, why they support him actively when they have another candidate. When they say there's a religious test and the person has to be religious, the only religious person in Trump's family is his daughter Ivanka, who is Jewish. Mm-hmm. You know, go figure. Hillary is very religious.
Yes.
When she was in the White House, she went regularly to church.
Right. And she credits so much of her own social formation to her youth minister in the United Methodist Church she was a part of, and did until the day he died.
Now, is it something because she's United Methodist? I just don't get this evangelical support of Trump, who has made up his own names of books of the Bible. He's misquoted the Bible. He's mischaracterized religious beliefs terribly. And there, he has fomented such a climate of hate. Why do evangelicals support him? Not just are they going to vote for him,
Why did they support him?
Actively support him.
Actively,
yes. Yeah. And of course, he identifies as a Presbyterian. That must give a lot of the Presbyterians I know pause. But I think evangelicals are nervous about their own status in this society.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they have enjoyed an outsized influence on the national news agenda and on the political scene. We can draw almost a straight line from Jerry Falwell's moral majority through to the present moment. And since we're here in Dallas, we do know well that the Southern strategy, which changed the whole tone and tenor of the Republican Party, was devised here in Dallas. Mm-hmm. And was promoted throughout the National Republican Party.
Yeah, I believe LaRon was instrumental.
Very.
I understand, yeah. We've already mentioned Robert Jeffress at First Baptist Church. Actually, his predecessor, W.A. Criswell, Wally Amos Criswell, mm-hmm. was the chief priest of that particular change that occurred in America. I think that they're nervous because Hillary Clinton expresses a great deal of what they are not.
Mm-hmm.
Evangelicalism, in some significant ways, is patriarchal.
Mm-hmm.
If elected president of the United States, we will have a woman who will be the most powerful office holder in the world. That is new for the United States of America.
Well, and let's face it, following the first black president.
Correct.
Yep.
And I think you've really done a service to us by identifying the source of that anxiety. Mm-hmm. There is a great deal of privilege at stake here. People believe their privilege is on the chopping block.
What's going to be taken from them when Hillary becomes president? If she does, if she's elected.
I would hope that the bad things are going to be taken away, things that that tend toward abuse of power.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that that there are people who are afraid that their voices are going to be discounted. They don't want to lose their ability to leverage political favors and activity for them and for their groups. But as a matter of fact, I think we found out in the United States that every time a minority's rights are upheld and expanded, it turns out to be good for everybody, including the majority.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. There is something at work in American life right now that I would call a spiritual sickness, a spiritual malaise. And that spiritual malaise has convinced a significant number of our voting public that they are going to have to try to stop the erosion of their values. That's not been the case. Donald Trump was an opportunist who seized an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
I think that he is the political and spiritual child of Sarah Palin. She was the one who plowed this road first,
mm-hmm.
and he simply stepped into her high heels.
Mm-hmm. You know, in a way, you can't blame him for certain things. The pastor of the largest Southern Baptist church in the country has endorsed him and is doing, I mean, it's quasi-legal, but that let the IRS figure that one out. But I wouldn't, if it was me and he was supporting me for the office I was running, I'd accept that support.
Yeah.
There's no reason not to.
As an Alliance Baptist who believes in the separation of church and state, I celebrate the position taken by the United States Constitution. That's what I'm in favor of here. And I do not perceive there to be any threat to faith and practice in a Clinton presidency.
Mm-hmm. Which are some of the rights that were taken away during Bill Clinton's presidency?
Yeah, it's a good point.
Oh, I was asking. Because I thought there was a whole long list.
I'm afraid you'd search in vain, wouldn't you?
Or what about during Barack Obama's presidency? Which ones were taken away?
Right.
Okay, so that's the values part, but there's so much more. There's the religious part, which he doesn't even pander to, really. He tries to, but they have to be smart enough to see through that.
Well, yes, but of course there are a significant number of people in the country, I believe, who think that their economic situation will be improved if a billionaire moves into the White House. They somehow believe that his perceived success, whether it's real or not, is another matter.
We don't know that.
We don't know because we've not been allowed to see his tax returns.
Right.
But they believe that somehow his success will rub off on them, so that they're almost afraid not to support him.
Mm-hmm.
Because they think that they're going to become somehow economically advantaged. The other side of that argument, I think, is that there are people on the conservative end of the spectrum, even good working class, blue-collar people, Democrats, who somehow believe that their economic situation will worsen in a Clinton presidency. It didn't the last time around when Clinton was in the White House, did it?
No.
And it certainly hasn't under Barack Obama at all. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, Barack Obama took us back from the brink of the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. But somehow the facts get lost.
My favorite Trump speech is the one that he made talking about, it was an economic speech about what a disaster Obama has been to the economy. And it was on the day that the Dow Jones hit a new record high of over 18,500.
Ironic, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, it's, but people don't put those kinds of things together. Okay, here's the other part of it, that I just don't get the evangelical support. I get that they would vote for him. I'm talking about the active support. You have Hillary Clinton, who they excoriate her for not divorcing Bill Clinton. How dare you work out your problems? Isn't that what a religious person is supposed to do in that context, in that religious context, when you can? Not stay in a dangerous position.
Of course.
Okay. And then we have Trump on his third marriage, and that's okay?
Apparently,
to me, it doesn't matter.
Apparently, they are willing to suspend that part of their religious restriction.
And
they're willing
really
to suspend
asking.
A lot of their religious. Apparently,
so you believe that what it really comes down to is economics. They believe that somehow they'll be better off because we won't have immigration coming across the southern border. Because we're going to export or throw out 12 million people, which we're not sure now what he believes on that, because he's saying he's going to bring jobs back to America.
Though a lot of his jobs have been exported.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. I mean, his one example is we need to make more steel here, and the reason that most steel jobs have been lost isn't because of exporting it, although that did happen some, but because of modern ways to make it, it just doesn't take as many people to do it anymore.
I think he's also tapped into a deep stream of American fear of the other.
Oh, absolutely.
And he's played it masterfully. In that regard, he has been a master marketer.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's sensed how nervous Americans are about immigrants, people who do not speak English as a first language, folks of a different religious heritage or of no religious heritage at all.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And we've got a long history in this country, a sad history, of the way that those kind of prejudices have been played upon by political movements and demagogues. Donald Trump is the latest example of
mm-hmm.
it. And there have been plenty of people, and I don't even want to limit it to evangelicals, because I think that there are moderates involved in this problem, too, religiously, who've jumped on that xenophobic bandwagon.
Well, you were talking about somebody before the show. You don't have to identify who it is.
Just somebody that I happen to know who lives their life actively.
Lives in Orlando.
Yes. And lives their life actively as somebody you would assume would be a liberal person, but they are young and they are supposedly going to vote for Donald Trump.
Now, this is somebody who had said good thing she didn't go to Pulse that night. She was thinking of it.
Right. But she had been there, sympathizes with, has gay LGBT friends. So situations like that, and I know that's not the only case.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just baffled by it.
Yeah. And the reason I don't mean to just pick on evangelicals.
Right.
He doesn't have just evangelical support. He has all kinds of support.
Right.
But as a Baptist minister, you'd be one to be able to explain that to us a little bit better. But I think what you explained was they just are suspending belief right now.
Yes, and evangelicals at this point are not that much unlike the rest of nervous America.
Mm-hmm.
They are a particular tribe of nervous Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that there will also be a significant minority of evangelical people, Baptists and others, who are going to vote for Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
People who have identified traditionally as Republicans in the country, who may not talk about it much, but when they get to the ballot box, they're going to vote their conviction.
And again, my question wasn't about why are they voting. It was why is there this active support?
Yeah.
And again, you're saying there's going to be a large group from there who's going to vote. They're not going to actively support.
Right.
They might talk to friends. They might talk to relatives and try to convince them that that this is why they're voting that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's that mass support that's coming from leadership that's not supposed to be really endorsing a candidate at all.
Correct.
That I find interesting. And that's what I was asking you about, just to get an understanding there, because it's baffled me. If I'm religious and that's something I like to see in an elected official, I'm going to vote for the one that's more religious.
Right.
If that truly is my value.
Sure.
We are just about out of time. Steve, I want to thank you for being here with us.
It is a pleasure.
So good to see you.
It's so good to be back. Ron and David and Joshua.
Yes.
It's really good to be with you here on KNON for Lambda Weekly.
Yeah, we always have an interesting discussion when you're here. Next week, our guest is Sharon Fine. She has started a group called Educare. Educare is working with senior facilities to train them to be how to work with LGBT people. Maybe one of them needs to take your course.
I want to take his course.
I do, too. It sounds very interesting.
Really,
so for all of us here at Lambda Weekly, we'll be back next week with more. And welcome back to Lambda Weekly Part 2.
Lambda Weekly 2.0.
The next show isn't here yet. I'm Dave Taffet. I'm here with Laurent Landis. Our guest the previous hour was the Reverend Steve Sprinkle. We were just talking. I think I see them driving in. So we can talk about just something real quickly. You were just saying something at the end of the show, and I cut you off.
One of the things that I'm very happy about is to see the interest that LGBTQ religious leadership sparks. Whenever we raise that possibility, it causes people to do a double take, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. It does.
It does. Please remember that here in the Metroplex, we have some of the most talented, faithful, and gifted religious leaders that the LGBTQ community has ever produced.
Mm-hmm.
And they're active this morning. They were active for Shabbat. They're active in mosques. They're doing it right now.
You know, one of the members at Josh's in my synagogue, and our synagogue was founded as an LGBT synagogue. One of the members is heterosexual couple. They have a son. Son has a condition that it manifests itself kind of like autism. And when they followed our previous rabbi there, but they stayed. And we asked them, we said, we're thrilled that you stayed. Is there any reason? And they said, oh, yeah, no other synagogue would let us bring our son with us. And we say, We told them we stopped the service to say hi if you walk in late, to give him a hug. He is who we are.
That's right. All right. That's right.
I mean, that's so much the reason that we are there.
That's correct.
So
that's another reason that I admire your synagogue so much.
And for anybody who doesn't know what we're talking about, it's Congregation Bethel, but no, we've been around now 30 years. 30.
It's a triumph. And it's no mistake that it's right here in Bigby.
And we meet right down the street, I shouldn't be saying this, but at North Haven United Methodist Church, which is another wonderful congregation that has just worked with everybody and everything, and you know, and that's the way religion should be. We're going to just put on a little bit of music for a minute while we change out shows. We'll see you next week.